Hey, we have two speakers, and the first speaker is Gayla from Florida.
I'm an addict. My name's Gayla. I'm not real sure where I'm going to start. I'm going to say one of the first things about this workshop was when you have low self-esteem, you don't see that there's miracles in your life. And hindsight is a whole lot better for me to see miracles. I could see miracles happen in your life before I could see miracles happen in mine. And I know they were there. Now I see the ones that were behind me. And even today I have problems having enough self-esteem and being self-important enough that God would put a miracle in my life when I know He does. And being in Narcotics Anonymous in the first place was probably a miracle that I didn't see for many years. And I had a boss that was an active addict, and I just couldn't maintain anymore. And I never lost a job, which probably was a miracle, but they're talking about miracles in recovery. And when I got to these rooms, it's like, you know, I would hear people say, well, I didn't lose a job, or I lost my job, lost my kids, lost my car, lost my house, and I'm thinking, maybe I'm not an addict. And sometimes that happens later on in our recovery, that we lose all those things, maybe because we weren't grateful for them. And I know my first meeting, it was a miracle that I ended up there, because I was doing these, trying everything in the book not to be at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, because I didn't want to be an addict, and I didn't really want to quit using. I just wanted to learn how to socially be acceptable and still use. And very rarely do we ever get here being socially acceptable anyway, let alone using. And I remember saying that in one of the meetings that I went to, and I'm glad the old-timers in there didn't laugh at me learning to use socially by coming to Narcotics Anonymous. And because I had a whole lot of stuff in my head, but not much of it was recovery-oriented. And the first meeting that I went to, I had talked to my boss's wife, and I told her, I said, you know, I think I have a drinking problem. Because I really wasn't sure where she'd be with me saying that I had a drug problem. Not that she probably didn't know, but I wasn't willing to give it up, you know. And she sent me to my first meeting, which was not of this fellowship. And right off the bat, I started making deals with God that if I drove up to the front of this place, which was this little bitty, modest church, and it was owned by the other fellowship, I guess, and if there was a parking place in front, okay, God, then I'll stop. And if there's not, I'm driving on by. And I had to go around a corner because there wasn't a parking place there, and there was a guy honking behind me, because I was craning my neck to see what was going on in there, because I didn't want to walk in there without knowing what, you know, what to be like, the chameleon, what to be like. And I couldn't see because the stairs went way up, and you really couldn't see eye level, even in the old drug van that I drove. And I went around the corner, and I said it again, okay, God, if there's a parking place in the front, I'll stop. The miracle was there was a parking place right in front of the meeting. So I stopped, and I didn't make the deal with him that I'd go in. What I did was I made the deal if there was an empty parking place, I'd stop. So I manipulated again. And I remember my car died after I pulled in the parking place. Was that a miracle? No, the miracle was that when I opened the door to get out and look under the hood and see what was the matter with it, there was a gust of wind blew me in this church. And it really freaked me out for a long time, but of course, being an addict, I wasn't about to admit that something greater than myself put me in there, because I didn't believe that. When I come to these rooms, I was an active Satanist, and I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe really in anything, but I did believe there were powers. And I was so freaked out by that feeling of being lifted up the stairs and into this little church, and that's the last place I wanted to be anyway, was in a church, that I saw one big table going straight down the middle of the church, and the only people that were in there were men. And of course the ego and the using addict woman decided, well, that's cool. There's no competition in here, because I wasn't looking too good by then. And the other part of me thought, I don't fit in. I don't fit in here. I didn't fit in the church. I didn't fit in the whole feeling that I had there. But I was too paralyzed to get up and walk out, because I was afraid whatever blew me in there would blow me back in the seat. And so I sat there and I listened. And I hadn't quit using. This was in May in 1984, and I hadn't quit yet. And there were a lot of events that I did in Narcotics Anonymous still using, because I knew about this fellowship, but I didn't want to go to meetings, per se, every night. I tried conventions, I tried conferences, I tried all kinds of things, but I didn't want to sit in meetings. And the meeting that I was in that night was just on a topic, and everybody shared, and it came my turn, and I passed. Because I didn't know what, this is the way I felt. I didn't know what I was supposed to say in there. I didn't know what they wanted me to say in there. And that's where it began, is where what somebody wanted me to say, so that I could fit in. And I remember leaving there and feeling like I should go back, but I didn't want to go back there. I wanted to continue to use and not tell anybody. And the marijuana maintenance program is what I finally chose, because I could eat. Because I was like 82 pounds. And that's about double what the woman I am today. Today, anyway. And I wasn't paranoid, because I'd given up enough stuff that I wasn't paranoid by then. And there was a couple of other meetings that were getting ready to go on, and I was trying to make decisions whether I was going to go. And I went to a meeting, and I was in detox too, so the program, the marijuana maintenance program that I was doing, was helping the detox, because I could at least eat. And I was sick, and my daughter came downstairs the night before I went to the next meeting, and I was real sick, and knew there was something wrong with my body, but I just figured it was because I wasn't using the dope. And I told her, I said, I think you need to call the emergency room, because I don't feel good at all. And when she called, I don't remember being picked up, and I don't remember going to the hospital, but I remember laying in the emergency room, hearing like you're floating along and you really don't know what's going on, but you hear things. And I heard him saying, we need to give her medication because she's detoxing. And I remember kind of sitting up in a stupor saying, that's why I'm in this place. Would you please just not give me any medication? I've been medicated way too long. And they said they couldn't keep me if they didn't give me medication unless I stayed right in the emergency room in the care that I was getting, because I had had a stroke. And I agreed, as long as they didn't give me any more medication. And it was like coming and going and not understanding what was happening around me. I could hear things going on around me, but yet being either sedated or something. And they said that they didn't give me anything. And I remember the doctor coming in and saying that your heart stabilized and you can go home. And I didn't really understand the magnitude of what had happened until later on. And I know that just not dying at that point was probably another one of those miracles. And I was still already, that was probably a week to 30 days into the program. And I didn't get clean until October. And I still kept going to meetings. I remember going to a meeting in that same place that I went to first, and there was probably about 25 people in there, still no women. There was one woman, but she was in worse shape than me, so when they would talk about sponsorship, I didn't think I really wanted to ask her, because she just, you know, I mean, I look bad enough, but she was in worse shape. And so I wasn't getting it, so I felt different again. And they had a meeting on honesty, and I wasn't being honest in those rooms because I was still coming in there loaded and thinking they didn't know. Yeah, right. Like addicts don't know when you're loaded in recovery. We know. But they don't tell you you can't come. It's like nobody told me that I couldn't come to Narcotics Anonymous loaded because most of us don't get it. I didn't have treatment. I didn't go to treatment. I didn't have enough money. I was afraid they would take my child away from me if I went to treatment. There were a lot of things going on in my head that kept me from going to treatment because of fear. And so I came in, detoxed in the rooms, and went to meetings. And they told me, you know, you're important. Don't stay away. Keep coming back here. And I remember getting my coffee, and I'd been all day long having these tremors from detox, you know, it's like those, oh God, and I don't know where they came from or what drug was doing it to me, but whatever it was, I just couldn't keep it together. And I couldn't keep my coffee still, so I'd hold my hand and put it down on the table and so nobody'd see that. Because it was all about looking good, you know. And I was sitting here beside, and it was like I said, that you couldn't even hardly get your chair out. It was so packed around this table. And I remember having one of those tremors and feeling like, oh my God, I just can't even keep my arms together, and I pissed in my seat. Now, can you imagine that in our little meetings today, if somebody actually urinated in their seat in detox? What would we do? Well, somebody whisked me out of my chair, and somebody else got the mop, and they moved me to another chair, and they brought me more coffee, God forbid, you know, and I tried it all over again, and there was two fellas sitting on each side of me, and they both said at the same time, they both whispered in my ear, we've all been here, don't be embarrassed, don't stop coming here because of that. And it was like, it set something in my thinking that no matter how sick I am in here, it doesn't matter, it's okay to be here, because they understand, they've already been here, they've already done that. And it was later on in my recovery when other things started happening. It's like I said, I can see the miracles in your life because I would hear you talk to me about them. And you were important. I didn't see myself important enough to have miracles happen in my recovery. And we had come back from a convention, and I was feeling like, you know, really gung-ho. And I got a telephone call about 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, there's not too many of us that call at 2 o'clock in the morning unless we're up to something. And this phone call was from my old dealer. And he said, all you got to do is go on a run. And I had lost the only job I ever lost and was in recovery. And I had just lost my job and was looking at anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000 a month in medical bills for my daughter because she had diabetes from way, way on, early on. And, you know, that look started looking good, that money. It was about the money. And I called the sponsor because I'd finally gotten a sponsor. That was a miracle, too, because just asking. Because I kept saying men with the men, the women with the women. Well, there weren't any. So I slammed the book on the table in my normal assertive self and ask if there was anybody going to sponsor me because I wanted to die. And he had to be at least 88 years old, rattled up on his cane, and he said, I'm going to take a lot of shit for this, but he said, I'm going to sponsor you. And he said, I've never done this before, but he said, there is nobody here to sponsor you. We come to these meetings all the time, and there aren't any women here that are staying clean. And he sponsored me at that time. And I called him up that night, and I told him that this is what's going on in my life, and I want to go make this money. And he asked me a very simple question. Can you have that in your possession and not use it? Well, I never thought of that. Of course, we don't think of that. And it's like I made the decision that I was just going to keep looking for work and I wasn't going to go do that. And the paper came out that morning and everybody that went was busted at O'Hara Airport. So I got that wave of warm feeling that, you know what, something just happened here because I did something different. And I felt like that was a miracle behind it, that I didn't go and do my normal thing to make that money. And another little miracle that happened was not too long after that. I had looked and looked for work there, and there just wasn't any, because my boss, the reason I lost my job, my boss went to treatment, because I must have been a miracle in his life, because I was doing something different. And whatever it was, he wanted to know what it was. And I talked to him about it, and he said, you know, he said, if I don't quit drinking, he said, I'm going to lose my family. I'm going to lose everybody in my whole life. And he went to treatment. So his law practice went. And I didn't see that miracle for a long time because he stayed in his recovery plan for a long time. And then he relapsed, and I had a chance when I went back up north to see my mother at 9/11 to talk to him on the phone, and he wasn't well. So I felt again like I was a miracle. I mean, why did God choose me to stay clean and all these other people keep relapsing? It was freaking me out. And my conditions where I was living were a little rough because I couldn't get a job. I still had house payments, and my daughter was pretty expensive with medical bills, and there was no insurance after the job quit, so I needed to do something quick because unemployment wasn't cutting it. And I made a decision. Somebody called, one of those miracles in the night, somebody called on the telephone and said, you know what, there's a lot of work in Nashville, Tennessee. If you're not afraid to get off your ass and move and work, you can make it here. And I thought, I did that foxhole prayer thing. I knelt at the foot of the bed and I said, okay, you know, I don't know what you want from me, but whatever it is, it obviously ain't here, so tell me what you want. And I woke up that morning knowing that I had to sell where I lived and get out of here. And I was just coming up on a year clean. In fact, the day I had loaded the U-Hauls, I was a year clean. And that's what they said. And I believe this program when they say don't make major decisions without either contacting a sponsor and a support group or have a year clean because your thinking's not quite so fuzzy. And I had fuzzy thinking. I had fuzzy thinking for 3 years. My best enemy was between the ears. And I put an ad in the paper because the only thing I could think of was, if I'm going to get out of here, I got to sell this place. And I'm thinking, you know, this is so stupid because there's no place. There's like 8 or 9 properties along that same subdivision that I lived in, and not a one of them had sold because the economy where I was living was really bad. And I put an ad in the paper, and like at 6 o'clock that night, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, evidently somebody got their paper and got up and read it early. I got a telephone call. She didn't want to come and look at the house. She didn't want to talk to me about the house. She wanted to go to the bank at 9 o'clock when it opened and take the house. She said she'd already drove by, and that's what she wanted and where she wanted to live. And again, it's like it felt like this warm breeze just blew my hair back. It's like, what in the hell is going on here? But today I know what a miracle it was, because I was supposed to go and finally ask for help through this higher power of mine and said, what do you want from me? What do you want me to do? And said enough did enough praying that I opened up to the suggestion because it came that morning. I don't know how long we're supposed to talk, but somebody's going to have to give me the throat cut because I have no idea what time it is. There were many miracles along the way. My father, I found out my father was going to die, and he was the inspiration in my life. And I started listening in meetings to how people handled that, and began to understand that you got to talk about the secrets that we hang on to that will eventually eat us up. And I heard how gentle they did it. Well, you know what? Some of us just aren't that damn gentle. I never have been one that knew how to lace everything up so it sounded proper. I just say it, and it always comes out the side of my neck. And I made arrangements to sit down with him and talk to him about how I felt growing up and how I felt about some of the things that went on in my life. I was the only child, went on in my life when he left the marriage to my mother and growing up alone without a dad, because I was more like my dad than I was my mother. And it didn't come out like everybody in the room said it would. What came out was, you did this, you did that, and I'm angry. And before you die, I want you to know how rotten I felt at these particular times in my life. And what became of that was another miracle. Never had he ever said, I love you. And not only did he tell me that he loved me, he told me that you've grown into a woman that is amazing. And then I moved on. When he died, I felt a sense of loss, but I also felt a sense of joy that I don't have to die with him. That part of my life is wiped clean now. We dealt with that. And a lot of times, things in my recovery today, I have to make a decision, and I have to put some action behind it, and then I can move on and walk away from whatever it was, because I don't have to keep doing it, and do something different. Doesn't mean it's going to be right either. It just means it's going to be something different, because I didn't get in here knowing the answers. I got in here making the same mistakes y'all do. The next one was knowing that my life was moving on, but I kept feeling that there was something dragging behind me after he died. And I just couldn't put my finger on what it was. And what it finally ended up being was my daughter was going to die, and he was the dress rehearsal. And was probably 5 years after she died before I could say it was a miracle. Because any mother knows that when your children die before you do, it's not a miracle. Not then. But the things that led up to her dying were, and I'm going to get a little out of the scope of Narcotics Anonymous in this, when she came home from school one day and she said there was a revival up the street. And she said, I don't know what I really did, but I got saved. So I know that's not Narcotics Anonymous related. But in my heart, it didn't hit me till after she died what she had said. And she went home. Before she died, we were at a camp out on the river. I lived in Johnson City area, and we had a camp out in, I can't even remember the name of that little town on the river. Afton, Tennessee. It's on the flyer. And I was always the cook. And we were up in the cabin cleaning up Sunday. And all weekend I kept feeling this strange feeling. And I very rarely left her alone. And this weekend, I didn't leave her alone either. Greg P. and Lois and the kids were staying at my house looking for a place to live in Tennessee from Atlanta. And I felt very safe and secure that my daughter was going to be okay when I went to that weekend. But I still had this grinding feeling in my guts that something wasn't right. And I'd call every night, and she'd aggravate me by saying she was eating crackers in the bed, which was not part of the rules. You don't eat crackers in the bed. And watching TV and stuff she wasn't supposed to watch, so she was just aggravating me. And I still didn't feel okay. And we were cleaning up. We were up in the cabin. The cabin was closed up, and it was a pretty warm day, so there was no air circulating in there. The windows weren't open. The air wasn't on. And the friend of mine's child's pictures and all the things that they color at school were all on the refrigerator with the magnets. God love magnets on the refrigerator. And all of a sudden, the whole house started blowing around. Things started blowing off the refrigerator, and there was a ceiling fan in the loft of the cabin, and the light dropped, like, right down at my feet. And I had this feeling that my whole body blew out of the building. And a very cold air came through there, and it was hot that day. And the phone rang. And I knew she came to say goodbye, because that's the kind of kid she was. Make a lot of noise, be aggravating, and I'm coming in, and I'm going out. And the phone rang, and they said she was in the emergency room, and they put life support system on her before they took her. So when I got to the hospital, she was on life support. Another miracle that happened in the place was we had somebody that was in the ministries, in the fellowship at the time, and she loved him to death. And I called him and I told him, I said, I got to do a fourth step and a fifth step here, and I don't know where to start. And y'all have to come and help me do this. And when we went in there, they had just told me they were going to shut the machines off. And at 6 years clean, I told her, I'll open you like a Christmas turkey, because you're not going to do it till I'm ready now. And showed my recovery a little bit. And that I wasn't using. And she reconsidered and waited until I was okay with this. And that was another miracle, because she had the power to do everything she wanted to do at that point. And I was able to leave that fifth step with her and be okay with our history. The present was a whole nother story. Because another miracle came along that I didn't kill myself in the closet that I sat in for months. I sat in the closet with a 357 for a long time, every night, making a decision. And God started opening things in my life as he shut the doors behind me. Not too long after that, my sponsor died, which I had one relapse, and with Greg living in the same area I lived in, and it was just too easy having that much history in our lives when he lived there through all that with me, not to have him for a sponsor. Either that or it was long-distance women. And when he died, there was another miracle that happened, because he'd been telling me for a long time after I moved to Florida, that because I kept telling him, I don't fit in with the women here. I just don't. I thought I was moving south, and I think I moved to New York, because everybody from Florida seems to be from the north. And I kept talking to him and talking to him and talking to him about, I just don't fit in. And he said, if you don't fit in the camp that you want to get in, make your own camp. And that very night, I talked to a woman that was losing both her foster kids back to the original mothers, and she was devastated. And I told her, I said, since you don't have a sponsor down here, and mine keeps telling me we have to have our own camp, I'm sponsoring you. Well, that's not necessarily the normal procedure, but You know, it's like we've become part of each other's stories. And the miracle of that is that we celebrated a family reunion in Tampa, Florida, and there were 900 people there Sunday. It was amazing to have that sense of home and that sense of family and that sense of belonging to something. I mean, I've always belonged to Narcotics Anonymous as a home group member, but I've never felt a home sense of belonging until this sponsorship family was part of it. And, you know, the miracles that happen in my life, I don't see them then because I'm all caught up in it. It's after it happens and I start really writing it down, because I'm not good at analyzing things. If I analyze it, I can screw it up. If I write it down, it's locked on paper and I have to look at it. And that's when I see the miracles in my life. Each time I do step work, it's brought to my attention that, do you see what happened there? And that's why I'm able to come and say these things to you, because to be quite honest with you, I still do not feel worthy enough, even in Narcotics Anonymous for 19 years, to have God make me important enough, put a miracle in my life. But I feel him today. And then the other part says, no, you're not that important, shut up. So don't listen back there, because it's always working. You know, it's always working on us. There's miracles in my life from all over. I mean, I can see, like, right now, three people that have been miracles in my life. This thing, when he came from wherever the hell he came from with a New York accent, Sabi, and Emily. It's a miracle I haven't killed Bill in a relationship. And, you know, it's like it just goes on and on and on because we're willing to stay here and keep struggling. And it is a struggle sometimes. I kept having this imaginary thing in my head that if I can just get past the cancer and just get past the chemo, that I'm going to be okay. And then it was like, just get past the bankruptcy because of all the medical bills, I'm going to be okay. And it's like, I'm one of those kind of people that see a room full of shit and I got to look, there's got to be a pony in here, you know. There's got to be something in here that put that in here. And I still have that attitude today because I know that God has so many miracles going on in my life that no matter how low it seems to get, there's always hope. And these rooms are what gives me the hope. I don't come in here with it. And I don't have it every morning. I get it when I come to a meeting. And they're watching their watch over here. Is it? All right. I'm going to be quiet now because my miracle today is that I'm still sucking air and being 19 years clean and coming back and seeing the people that helped me climb this ladder of recovery, because that's what the steps do for me. It's like each step gets me a little further along here and gives me a little more knowledge that I'm strong enough to keep doing this. I love y'all. Thanks.